Chapter 33, Greece, a Celebration of Life. Free at last in the magnificent land of Greece. On the morning of my release from the Athens hospital, I set off to see the Parthenon. Weak and dehydrated, I somehow managed to walk up the Acropolis, a hill that takes its name from the ancient Greek fortifications. At the top, a bright September sun warmed me as I rested against the beautiful columns of the Parthenon and eventually stretched out on the straight-cut, square white stones beneath them. The looming pillars above framed a brilliant sky. Such a luminescent blue should be named a whole new color, as the simple word blue seemed a poor description of its stark beauty. The ancient Greece that I had dreamed about as a young boy reading Homer's Odyssey and the Iliad kept filling my imagination. Impressions of the Greek authors such as Herodotus, Aristotle, Euripides, and of course Socrates through the works of Plato now flooded back. It seemed I was present 2,500 years ago, and at any moment Socrates would stroll up the stairs, students at hand. Even before reading the Odyssey, the Greek myths and fables entranced me as a small child. Later, I read the history of Sparta and Athens, the melding of history and myth in the story of Helen of Troy, the stories of perhaps the greatest conqueror of all time, Alexander, and the courage of Leonidas and his Spartan warriors at Thermopylae. They all came alive in these magnificent temple ruins. To think that many of the Greek heroes had sat here where I now rested. Could it be true that the first time that they saw this sight, that their hearts were filled with the same awe and reverence that these columns evoked in mine? Maybe they had lain between these Doric pillars and stared up at the Aegean sky with the same appreciation felt in my heart in that exquisite moment. Having had a close brush with death, a keener appreciation grew in me for life and the love of life the Hellenes promoted. I felt reborn in the land of our mutual ancestors, the land of our Western cultural genesis. The Greek unbridled reverence for life that I had read about found meaning in my own thankfulness to be alive. While in the hospital the previous few days, I read only Greek histories and literature. My nurse kindly went to the base post exchange and bought about 10 paperback editions of different English translations of Greek writings. They touched such a chord that although I was sick and alone in Athens, no melancholy came over me. The words I read nursed me back to health as much as the medicine I swallowed. Every American young person should travel the world. They must let their knowledge become animated in the feel, taste, smell, sight, and sound of the geography and history that they learn about. Even seeing a film of a place is not the same as being there, for film is just cellulose or electrically charged videotape. Actually being there makes the place and its history become real. Once a man is physically present, he becomes part of a greater reality rather than just an observer. Facts of history grow alive in the young mind. It makes the racially conscious realize that they're not just mere observers or even cheerleaders for their heritage. They are participants, the last link in a chain spanning the centuries and generations. It makes a man realize the value of his inheritance as well as his solemn obligation to pass it on. Growing up in an era in which our civilization has regressed and that our race has retreated can cause melancholy because of the seemingly insurmountable difficulty of our task. But learning of the terribly hard times in the history of the Greeks and their subsequent heroic periods encouraged me. Knowledge of the heroism and achievement of our forefathers sparks those genetic traits in us. Being physically present in historic places makes the words in musty old books become alive in flesh and blood. To feel beneath my own feet the hard stone upon which Socrates once stood made his words and wisdom more immediate and pertinent. Around 3000 BC, our Aryan ancestors, speaking various forms of the Indo-European language, invaded what is now the Greek peninsula. The Aryan tribes included the Achaeans, who overran the Peloponnesus, the Ionians, who migrated to Attica, the Aeolians, who settled Thessaly, and the Cyclades, who assimilated with the Helladic people. The Dorians left their mountain homelands and became the dominant Indo-European tribe in Greece. But all the tribes eventually became known as Hellenes, or Greeks. Greek mythology explains the genealogy of Greece as the descendants of Helen, hence the word Hellenes. That's what denotes the Greek people. Somewhere around the 12th century BC, about the time of the period depicted in the Iliad and the Odyssey, and coinciding with the Iron Age, Greek civilization began to make its powerful imprint on the ancient world. As the Aryan tribes invaded and established their kingdoms, the tribal chiefs became the kings of the conquered lands and ultimately were replaced by aristocratic oligarchies, which in turn gave way to alliances among the rich commoners and some disgruntled aristocrats. It seems that all of Greece experienced such cycles over the centuries. Dictators replaced periods of liberal democracy, later to be overthrown by aristocrats, who were to be replaced by meritocratic middle classes, only to have dictators wrest control again. It should be noted that even in the most democratic periods, democracy was never democratic in the modern sense. Greek democracy was always limited to a narrow and privileged class called citizens, and voting was never an inherent right, but a privilege earned either by hereditary line or based on ability and accomplishment. Slavery was an accepted fact of life in Greece, but those who were free were perhaps freer than any people who ever lived. In any event, throughout all the political upheavals and frequent warfare of ancient Greece, the cultural and artistic levels soared to heights most notably expressed in the Periclean Age, heights that had never been equaled. We now know that the earliest ancestors of the Greeks had the first bronze metallurgy in the Balkans thousands of years before anywhere else on the planet. We also know that the Golden Age of Greece was indeed an age of golden people, with Greek literature and art clearly depicting a fair-complected, predominantly light-eyed people. The Greeks were trade-conscious and imperialist, and as Greek civilization rose, it began to conquer and administer an empire that stretched throughout the known world. Alexander the Great, technically a Macedonian, arose as a despot in the last imperial stage of their fading greatness in the 3rd century before Christ. He used a unique system to incorporate new lands and peoples into his empire. He would often require his soldiers to marry into the ruling classes of the kingdoms he conquered, thinking that by inculcating them into Greek families and culture that he was making more Greeks. Upon the defeat of Persia, he presided over the marriage of thousands of his soldiers with the daughters of Persia's ruling class, even though after Alexander's death, most of those mixed are called Susa marriages, were dissolved by the more thoughtful Greeks back home. Other racial threats increased. Commerce, immigration, and increasing intermarriage between Greeks and foreigners slowly transformed Greece into a melting pot of the Mediterranean world, and the vitality of the Greek civilization faded over time, as I've noted earlier. The mixing in Greece was not as dramatic as had occurred in Aryan India, but substantial change did occur. Many of the people of Greece today retain traces of noble ancestors, and they are indeed worthy of their heritage. But the Golden Age was lost as the light of the genes of the Hellenes became dimmed with the absorption of the alien. Although primitive in comparison with the scientific accomplishments of the modern world, The ancient Greeks reached the pinnacle of civilization in the arts, philosophy, and government. The intellectual and artistic level of the creative elite exceeded that of any society before or since. Today, we only have scant traces of the poetry and literature, painting, sculpture, theater, and architecture of a society from which we still learn so much, 3,000 years after its greatest flowering. It amazes me to think that the plethora of magnificent art, architecture, philosophy, and literature emerged from city-states that probably never had a combined population exceeding 250,000 people. As I grew healthier, I began to travel about the magnificent country and was impressed with the beauty, the hospitality, and loveliness of the land and the people. I felt as if I were viewing an entire earlier time through the filter of the modern world. Near the time of my departure, I traveled to the plains of Marathon and then to Thermopylae, once a narrow pass, but now a wide floodplain. I reverently walked across the once blood-drenched fields of that great battle 2,500 years ago. The story of King Leonidas offered a magnificent example of a man of our race who will defend his heritage regardless of the personal cost. The words I had read years before from the world's first true historian, Herodotus, came to life before my eyes. The Persian kingdom, a rich empire dominated by Indo-Europeans, but with a largely non-Aryan population of Asia Minor from which to draw an army, had its sights set on the beauty of ancient Greece. King Darius' army began its invasion soon after Ionia and some other Greek coastal states revolted against Persian rule. Ultimately, his force found defeat in the Greek plain of Marathon. But his son Xerxes I soon assembled an even larger force, the largest army and navy in the history of the ancient world. In 481 BC, Xerxes and his army crossed the Hellespont Strait on a bridge of boats and headed south toward Athens. The Asian invasion could not have occurred at a worse time. The Greeks were largely unprepared and bickering among themselves. At the moment of the invasion, the Spartans were engrossed in the most important of their religious festivals. Leonidas, a Spartan king, saw the danger clearly and marched with a small force of about 7,000 to the most naturally defensible position on the Greek mainland, Thermopylae, a pass only about 50 meters wide. The Spartans were the most skilled soldiers in the world and had a code of honor unbreakable even in death. Leonidas decided that the Greek people could only survive if he and his warriors held the pass long enough to allow the rest of the city-states to organize their defense. 2 days went by, and Leonidas's band held the pass despite being outnumbered hundreds to one. With each day, he bought time for his people, and he knew too that his example would rally his countrymen. Near the end of the siege, Leonidas discovered that a Thessalian trader named Ephialtes had shown the Persians a hidden path over the mountains, enabling the encirclement and doom of Leonidas and his men. Knowing that his position would eventually be overrun, Leonidas ordered most of his fellow Spartans to leave the battlefield and prepare for the battles he knew would lay ahead. Looking over the ancient battlefield, I recall Leonidas's response to a soldier who said that the air would be so filled with Persian arrows that they would blot out the sky. He responded that they would then just have to fight in the shade. With only 300 of his finest Spartan soldiery and about 1,100 others, mainly Thebans and Thespians, who refused to leave his side, Leonidas, in an act of heroism that has inspired our race countless times over the centuries, chose to die so that his people might live. The Greek epitaph over the dead at Thermopylae is simple and powerful. Stranger, tell the Spartans that we lie here in obedience to our duty. Greece reeled under the Persian advance, but after the sacking of Athens, Greek forces rallied. Under the command of Themistocles, the Greeks destroyed the Persian navy at Salamis, and mostly Spartan forces later defeated Xerxes' army at Plataea. The heroism and sacrifice of Leonidas lived in every Greek's heart and drove them on to victory in much the same way that shouting, "Remember the Alamo," inspired the men who defeated Santa Anta at San Jacinto. A Persian victory could well have meant the end of the West and the traditions we now cherish. Such is the power of one man's will to change the course of history. Overlooking the battlefield, I wondered where the Leonidases, the Colonel Travises, and the Crocketts of our day were. There are millions of men and women of our heritage who know that the non-white immigration and differential birth rates will mean our own racial genocide unless we alter our current course. If the alien media masters and the corrupt men who control our Western governments have their way, our unique genotype will be lost forever. A devastating flood of non-white genes will drown our civilization and threaten even our very existence as a people. Yet with such a racial catastrophe looming, too few are willing to sacrifice even modest amounts of their time or money for something that should be far dearer to them. Countless millions of our progenitors in history have risked their lives, and when one considers the many who knowingly gave their lives so that we could be here today, how can we not make at least a meager sacrifice so that our descendants will be here tomorrow? Every day we delay will mean greater loss of our people's precious blood in the future. Looking upon the fields of Thermopylae brought home to me the fact that I should not complain about any price I had to pay, for those battlefields were consecrated by the bodies and blood of men who gave so much more than what is asked of us. Their sacrifice enables us to be what we are, men of the West. I also understood that if we should fail in the struggle, even their precious gift of long ago would be in vain, forever muted by our own cowardice. For if we are no longer here to venerate these men, no one shall. It is not the ephialtes of the present who most disturb me. There will always be traitors who will sell out their heritage and birthrights. But I am most disheartened by those of our own kind who know the truth but refuse to act. They do not join the ranks of the enemy, but neither do they devote themselves wholeheartedly to our vital cause. Leonidas did not expect all of Greece or even all of his men to die with him. Once he knew the battle was lost, he sent many of them away more effectively at another time and place. Not every white man and woman can be expected to make the sacrifices or take the risks that their leaders must. But every racially conscious white person must take some kind of action for our cause. Every true Aryan makes the cause of our heritage and freedom every bit as important of the rest of his or her basic human needs. That's how it should be. The cause must become an integral part of the life of every racially aware white man and woman. Only when one becomes committed to the survival and advancement of our heritage and acts upon it does he or she deserve the title Aryan. Many stories of sacrifice similar to Leonidas's have been written, at Tours by Charles Martel, at Terbingen with the Teutonic Knights against the Huns, at Blood River in South Africa, at the Alamo, even at Stalingrad, where brave men fought to contain the Bolshevik plague. At 1,000 more battlefields, European men willingly laid down their own lives for the life of their people. Certainly, we can give our time and financial support in the cause of our very survival. One lesson of the ancient Greek history is the futility and fratricidal character of the Greek conflicts. When they were racially strong and united, the Greeks dominated the known world. Only the Greeks could destroy the Greeks, and truly, they extinguished themselves by their own folly. They did it both by internecine warfare, such as the Peloponnesian Wars, and by a cosmopolitanism and internationalism that eventually took a genetic toll from which they could not recover. Modern scientific knowledge will eventually create moral codes that will preserve and advance our genotype, but I suspect halting the fratricidal conflicts that have decimated our people will be a far more difficult task, one that will require considerable contemplation. Our European heritage has survived despite the war between the states and the First and Second World Wars, catastrophes for our heritage, but it cannot survive any more Peloponnesian conflicts. It is absolutely our duty to put aside any regional and cultural animosities that exist between Europeans anywhere in the world, while still cognizant and protective of individual white cultures and traditions. We must unite to confront our common enemy. The internationalists who would destroy all of our national traditions and even our very genotype itself. I do not know of any more courteous and friendly people than the modern Greeks. I have seen the light of our race in their eyes. As the Greeks, as well as the other Europeans, eugenically face the future, the genes that created the ancient Greek civilization will again come to the fore and illuminate the Greece of the next age. They will certainly share its light with the reborn artistic firmament that shall bathe the Western world. My last memorable visit while in Greece was to an old unnamed marble temple on a hill overlooking the Aegean. Looking out from the broken white columns toward the horizon, where the aqua blue of the water mistily joined the perfect blue of the sky, I felt the spirit of the people that built these monuments. I shared in their blood. Their genes were in me. For a day in the shadows of the ancient columns with a cool breeze coming up from the sea, I read passages from Herodotus, Thucydides, and Sophocles. I realized that although the Greeks would risk and suffer death for their honor and for their duty, yet, at the same time, no people on earth loved life more. They had the perfect union of body and spirit. In the ancient world of toil and tyranny, where often death was simply a relief from the pain of living, many ancient cultures concentrated their thoughts on the afterlife. The Greeks, on the other hand, created a world of art and architecture, heroism and beauty, and thus celebrated life. The miseries of the ancient world made previous societies elevate the unworldly and the unseen, but the Greeks reveled in the beauty of mankind, or more correctly stated, in that spark of the divine that they could find in man. As Egypt was a society mesmerized by the world of the dead, their greatest expressions being the cold, deep tombs of the pharaohs, the Greeks worshipped the noble urges of life. Their temples were open and executed in the scale of the living, not in the dark, encumbered rooms of the dead. Living men and women came together beneath the elegant and monumental architecture to commune with their gods, to venerate life, and to inspire them to nobility in spirit. Aristotle expressed the Greek love of life and beauty in a way that every Aryan can understand intuitively today. Quote, "We take pleasure in a statue's beauty. Should not the living fill us with delight? And all the more if in the spirit of the love of knowledge we search for causes and bring to light evidences of meaning. Then nature's purpose and her deep-seated laws be revealed in all things, all tending in her varied work to one form or another of the beautiful." That's from D.A. Thompson, The Legacy of Greece, and his quotation from Aristotle. In contrast to the secrets held by only the Egyptian priesthood and the magical arts that ruled the Mediterranean, the Greeks believed in open inquiry, with no holy man to mediate between man and their God. To them, there were no revealed truths, but only the natural truth toward which all men had a duty to aspire. An evening of the learned in the age of Pericles found men engaging in spirited conversation and debate about the nature of life itself. The poet John Keats summed up the Greek ethic in the great lines from Ode on a Grecian Urn. Quote, "Beauty is truth, truth beauty, that is all ye know on earth and all ye need to know." Edith Hamilton, an authority on ancient Greece, wrote that by having no vital lies, meaning no revealed truths, the Greeks could afford an open-mindedness unlike that of any other ancient civilization, and much less superstitious than even our own. They had no holy writ in constitution or in sacred text. They found their ultimate guidebook inscribed in the nature around them, a vision of nature that included them. They could afford to put every idea at risk, for they had no fear from an inquiry into truth. I thought about the vital lies of racial and sexual equality in our modern civilization and about how anyone who challenges them is excommunicated from accepted society as surely as any heliocentric astronomer faced condemnation in the Middle Ages. And I thought how Socrates would have laughed at the idea that any story such as racial equality or the Holocaust should be immune from examination. Euripides said it so clearly. A slave is he who cannot speak his thought. To me, Periclean Greece represented the true ideals crafted by Thomas Jefferson in the Bill of Rights. In the early days of our American Republic, not only were the Bill of Rights revered, they were practiced in principle in the minds and the hearts of men. Such can be shown by the often radical writings of Thomas Paine, whose pronouncements were freely read in his times, but whose sentiment a politician could today express without utter ruin. Political and religious free thought and speech are the most vital of men's rights. Without free thought and speech, no other rights can be safe, nor can we ever truly strive for the truth. The one great commandment of the Greeks was to know thyself. If we men of the West are to find our way to the greatness of spirit that represented Greece, we must then learn who we are and make our sacred identity the banner we wave in the winds of the cultural war. And how did the Greek see himself? A knowledgeable man was one versed in nature. And the Hellenes saw mankind as a vital part of nature. They sought no relief from nature's vagaries, but to live in the eternal tempest of life and wisdom. They were the first scientists and the first to understand the interrelatedness of all living things. The Greek also saw himself apart from other men. Plato wrote, "The Egyptians, the Phoenicians love money while we love knowledge." But in a later age, they egotistically thought they could make the whole world Greek simply by teaching their truths and sharing their visions of beauty. They failed in that quest, but their truths about life and truth were picked up from the dust of history by men whose genes were moved by that same spirit. The spirit of ancient Greeks is our spirit. Only Western man can truly relate to what the Greeks felt and created. The Greek intellectuals argued for harmony between the intellect and the spirit. Their art and architecture reflects it. In her wonderful book, The Greek Way, Edith Hamilton relates the story of a famous Greek artist who painted a picture of a boy holding a bunch of grapes so lifelike that the birds flew down trying to peck at them. The populace hailed the artist as a master. "If I were," the artist answered, "the boy would have kept the birds away." As Hamilton says so eloquently, grapes were to be painted to look like grapes and boys to look like boys, and the reason was that nothing could be imagined so beautiful and significant as the real. How that attitude conflicts with the alien and Jewish-inspired modernistic art that pervades the West today, where a chimpanzee's scratchings can sometimes fetch a king's ransom. A cult of ugliness has pervaded the spirit of the West that wrenches us from our own culture. To all true men of the West, the contemporary alien way of the arts is as base and ugly as the Greek way is noble and beautiful. Reading of the Greeks' unrestrained joy of life made me think of the doomsayers and the humorless people in our own movement who never allow themselves to see the good and the beautiful around them. They become so wrapped up in the horrors accompanying the demise of the West that they lose sight of their own inner nature, which, like the Greeks, can dance even in the face of annihilation. Embracing the dance of life affords us the effrontery to prevail against great odds. Living in these challenging times is no terrible burden. It is a great privilege and adventure. It is our great chance to realize a vision of the beautiful world we can create. It is not hatred of our enemies that gives us power. It is the sweep and grandeur of our vision that drives us forward. And it is that appreciation of beauty that keeps us living fully despite the darkness of the modern world. We strive, even in our own imperfect lives, toward the development of the divine in man that can lead to, as Nietzsche said, an evolutionary step beyond man. Long ago, Aristotle talked about developing those qualities. Quote, "There is a life which is higher than the measure of humanity. Men will live it not by virtue of their humanity, but by virtue of something in them that is divine." We ought not to listen to those who exhort a man to keep to man's thoughts, but to live according to the highest thing that is in him. For small though it be in power and worth, it is far above the rest. The illness that struck me as I left Israel could have easily killed me. Life is so fragile and so short, I thought. Why not do what I am meant to do? the demands of my cause and the hardships I knew were inevitable no longer loomed as a burden, but as simply the small price that I would pay for living a life of rapturous struggle rather than of resignation. I began to see the striving as a thing of joy and beauty rather than of hardship. I rejoiced in Euripides' notation that man without fear cannot be a slave. My close call on Israel, coupled with the wisdom of the Greeks, had set my spirit free. I stayed on in southern Greece for a few days, slowly regaining my strength. Although in much discomfort, I never complained. Instead, I was thankful that I was able to have such feelings. Every bit of pain was now a signal that my physical body was alive and growing stronger. I had a reason to live, and the sacred cause in my heart only grows more vibrant the longer I live. I had a reason to rejoice, for I felt I was now in the close company of those men of antiquity who had fought in their own way for the same things I now fought for: the survival and advancement of our people, our culture, and our freedom. On the plane heading for Rome, above the engine's drone, the words of Aeschylus played in my head. For freedom, sons of Greece, freedom for country, children, wives, freedom for worship, for our fathers' graves. The next chapter is chapter 34, To Europe and Home.